Hi, good afternoon. My name is Barry Dorans. I basically own all of ASP.NET security. And I'm here today to talk about not the simple security things, but the things that we've done wrong. The things that have caused MSRC cases and Patch Tuesdays, and I know how everybody loves Patch Tuesdays. And then things that we've caught in code review that you yourselves might end up doing by accident. So hopefully, you'll get to see things beyond SQL injection and cross-site scripting and stuff like that, and things that are a little bit more complicated and a little bit more subtle. I'm on Twitter at @blowdart. It's not a particularly work-focused account. For example, today I posted a picture of the Swedish chef that's going around in someone's backpack, which made me absolutely delighted. So, we're going to go through the code that caused 4 MSRC cases, and then some talk about Unicode, how you get encryption wrong, how uploading zip files and unzipping them on your server is not a good idea, some certificate comparisons, and some little bits of XSS. So I'm going to start with the MSRC cases, because that's a major part of my job. What happens is a security researcher will email secure@microsoft.com. Microsoft Security Research Center opens a case, and I get an email in my inbox. And at that point, I panic, because I don't like these at all, because we've done something wrong. And so I look at the report, I look at the sample code the researchers provided, if they've provided any, and then I try and reproduce their results myself. And then, if I have reproduced it, I'll hand it off to someone else, one of our servicing team, who will go ahead and try and reproduce it against every single supported operating system and every single combination of supported .NET frameworks on those operating systems. As you can imagine, that's a rather large test matrix. When we've got all the validation done and all of the various bits of investigation around it, we'll develop a fix. We'll test the fix. And those things are reasonably quick. We can sort of turn that around in a week. And then we write the bulletin. We then test everything again and all of those operating systems and all the versions of .NET. And that's what takes the length of time. That test matrix can take 1 to 2 months, depending on how complicated it can be. We then deploy the fix internally. And we watch to see if anyone's machines internally fall over and crash. And finally, if we think we've got the fix right, and normally we get it right, we'll actually write up the security bulletin, and then we'll release it on a Patch Tuesday at 10 a.m. Redmond time, because America doesn't believe that any countries exist outside of its borders. So I'm going to go through 4. Here we have the bulletin numbers, which are not very interesting, but you can look everything up. The slide deck and the sample code are available on my website, or at least they will be tomorrow once the conference is over. So you can download everything and have a play yourself. The first vulnerability we have is a hash denial of service. When we take form inputs or HTML headers or query strings, we create a dictionary out of them. And that dictionary is backed by a hash table. So the key in the dictionary is not the string value. It is a hash of that string value. We take the string value and we compute a number out of it. And the reason we do that is it's easier to look up. It's easier to find because hashes are evenly distributed. The problem with this is the hashing algorithm that we used was well known. So someone could pre-compute a bunch of input field names that collided. That is to say, they have the same hash or hashes that are very, very close. When that happens, inserting new values into a hash table becomes computationally expensive. And I'll demonstrate this in a bit. And the way we fix it is we change to a hash function that is unpredictable, or we limit the amount of form fields that we are accepting. limiting the amount of form fields was the quick patch that we put out. And then we changed the entire hashing algorithm to use a random value as part of its seed so nothing could be pre-computed. So, to explain this, and I should say this is not just a .NET vulnerability. The original research was on PHP, Java, Python, and JavaScript, and then someone decided to make my life miserable and port it across to .NET. If you imagine that you're the owner of a cattery, I don't know how to translate that, a place where people who are going on holiday leave their cats so they can be looked after. So a customer comes up, and he hands his cat over, and you ask, what is the cat's name? And the cat's name in this instance is Alphonse. So we take Alphonse's name, and we compute a hash value out of it. Because I'm lazy and I'm a cat owner, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the first letter of that cat's name, and that will be the room in which the cat is stored. So Alphonse goes into room A, Bertrand goes into room B, and so on. Then there's an evil cattery owner, and he wants to destroy my business. So what he does is he gets a bunch of his friends to turn up, and all their cats are named the same. They're all named Alphonse. So 1,000 people turn up with 1,000 cats, all named Alphonse, and I have to put them all into room A. Are there any cat owners in the room? Yes, I see. Oh, audience interaction in Scandinavia, that's kind of rare. Yeah, I've done this before. Dragging questions out of you and the Norwegians is really hard. So, the people who own cats will know that sometimes cats don't get on. And you can imagine the hissing and the spitting and the fighting and the scratching when 1,000 cats all named Alphonse go into the same room. Here's your denial of service attack. And when you try and retrieve the values, you have to go into the room, pick up each individual Alphonse, and try and figure out if it's the right one that you're looking for, which takes an awful lot of time. So that's my analogy of how a hash DOS works. So we fixed this. And we fixed this only if your dictionary key is a type of string. So that's fair enough for query strings. That's there for forms. But if you yourselves are creating dictionaries from user input, and you're not using a string as the key, for example, you're getting an object yourself and building that object, and if you've overridden get hash code, which a lot of people do, you're going to be vulnerable to this. And I can demonstrate it as I tab over, because I'm going to show a very, very naive string value. Here is my dumb string class. And my dumb string class just returns a fixed hash code for absolutely everything. So even if the cat was named Bertrand, he would still get a hash code of A. And what I'm going to do is we have a simple dictionary of string, and I'm going to shove in a million things into this dictionary. And then I'm going to create a dictionary with my dumb string, and I'm going to shove another million in, and we'll see what happens. All these demos are command line demos, except for one, because command line demos are really easy to write. So I'll hit start, and it's put the good value in, and we've got it in 671 milliseconds. And now it's trying to put things into the dictionary with the bad string, where the hash code is always the same. Anyone that owns a Surface knows what happens when the CPU starts to strike. You can feel it getting really hot here. And I can feel it getting really hot here. And if I leave this, it's going to take about 10 minutes. So when we have this problem, in fact, I'll just go Control-C, because per Surface. When we had this problem, people could send a specially crafted form requests to an ASP.NET website and bring down the ASP.NET site with one request. So, you don't use user input as keys in your dictionaries unless that user input is being converted to a string, or the get hash code implementation for the input is strong, and you implement a session key. So what I mean by that is when your application starts up, you have a static random value in your object class, and that is combined into your get hash code. So every time your program runs, get hash code changes. People don't like get hash code changing for some reason, even though we never promised it would be the same from run to run. For some reason, some people have stored get hash code in their databases. So the get hash code randomization is not turned on by default. I will show you how to do it towards the end of the presentation, because you have to opt in to a lot more fixes. And in ASP.NET 5, it's on by default, because we're breaking the world with ASP.NET 5, and we don't care. So we're going to make it on by default and do the right thing by default, and there's no way around it. The next vulnerability is a padding Oracle attack. This is really heavy in maths. So there is no demo, because I've tried to reproduce the original attack, which was in Perl, and I can't do it because I can't understand the maths in the white paper. What happened was there was an endpoint, webresource.axd, which was there as part of web forms originally, but still existed in MVC because it was all registered and everything was clumped together. And you could send a string to that endpoint, and it would say, yes, this string is encrypted correctly, or no, this string is not encrypted correctly. And it did that really quickly, and it did it byte by byte. So what an attacker could do was he would send a string, and it would return really quickly if it was the first character that was wrong. And he keeps doing that and iterates really quickly, and he gets the first character right. And then he does it for the second character, and then the third character. And so he can build up an encrypted string without knowing what the encryption key is extremely fast. And what script resource or web resource does, well, it was supposed to serve resources embedded in DLLs out as script files. What the attacker did was he scripted a request for web.config. It's not a very, very long string, so he could do it really, really quickly. And when he served that up and got web.config correct, web.config appeared in the browser. This is not a good thing because of machine key. Machine key in web.config, something else we've thrown away for ASP.NET 5, was our master encryption key for forms authentication tickets, view state signing, and a bunch of other stuff we used internally. So an attacker would see the key if it was set, and he would be able to forge forms authentication tickets for any user in your system whatsoever, because the forms authentication format is open, and we've released the source. So we fixed this by adding a signature to the encrypted string, and that uses a different key. So if you discovered, well, what would happen then is when the user sends, the attacker sends a request to scriptresource.axd and says, here, is this encrypted? We check the signature first. And if the signature isn't there or the signature is wrong, we know it's a forged request and we can reject it. So the way it worked was that encrypted data is padded out to meet algorithm requirements because of block ciphers, and it was that padding that failed. And checking the padding is basically a length on a number of bytes. And like I say, it's really, really fast. So each of these slides has links or descriptions of the original papers and the conferences at which they were presented at. So you can go away and read the mathematics for yourself. And if you do that and can explain it to me, please someone send me an email. So there are two ways to fix this. You don't expose this sort of thing. You don't have an endpoint that says, is this encrypted data correct? And when you are round-tripping encrypted data to the client, you add a signature to it. And when it comes back in, you validate that signature before you perform any decryption operations whatsoever. And if you come to tomorrow's session, which is Cryptography 101, I'll show you various types of signatures that you can do and use to provide this sort of protection, providing I can get the demos working tonight. Third one, SharePoint. I love SharePoint. SharePoint makes me really happy because they do strange and silly things. How many of you here are still using web forms? I am so sorry. So, those of you that are using web forms will know the horror that is ViewState. ViewState is a large hidden field that appears on every single web form's web page. And what that ViewState field is basically a bunch of serialized objects. When you enable ViewState, you can tell ViewState to be unencrypted, encrypted, or encrypted and signed. You really want the last one. Because what someone could do if it was unencrypted is they could just serialize a bunch of objects and put them in their ViewState. And when it comes back into WebForms goes, ooh, here is my ViewState. I'm going to deserialize all those objects and create them. And there are certain objects in C#, in the .NET framework, that are serializable that probably shouldn't be, including ones that can enable remote code execution. So, unfortunately, SharePoint turned all the protections off. Their ViewState in some pages was not encrypted. It was not encrypted and signed. So the researcher just used some of these objects that support remote code execution, and then we have an unholy mess. And the object that they used was temp file collection. I have no idea why this is serializable. That was not a good thing to do. However, we can't mark it non-serializable because of backwards compatibility. Temp file collection class basically is used to generate a bunch of temporary files, and then when it's disposed, it deletes all those temporary files. And so it has a property on it that is an array of file names that will be deleted when the class is disposed. So you can see where this is going. What the researcher did was he spun up an instance of temp file collection. He then added web.config as the file that would be deleted. And so he put that into ViewState. He posted the form to SharePoint. SharePoint happily deserializes this temp file collection with its web.config as the file to be deleted. And then you sit there and wait for the application pool to recycle, which happens a lot because SharePoint crashes. And when that happens, web.config is gone, and your SharePoint site is never coming back up again. So I have a little demo of this, not against SharePoint, because that would be very mean. So here we have a directory. I'm sorry, it's very hard to see at the back. I'm going to hit start, and what this does is it creates a web.config right here in this directory. If I drop that down there, bring that up here, I then create a temp file collection with web.config as the path. And when I hit enter, it's going to read this view state file. It's going to force garbage collection, because let's face it, no one wants to wait until the app pool recycles. And oh, whilst I was talking, web.config is gone. So, same fix as last time. When you run trip state to user control space, you sign the data. The other important thing is you don't publish your signing key. Alexandre went through an awful lot of open source projects after he discovered this, and I spent a bunch of time with him emailing the owners of these open source projects, especially the ones that were in the Azure application gallery, the ones that you could spin up with one click. Because an awful lot of applications had their signing key set in web.config. They used machine key. And when you have a set single machine key that's the same for absolutely everybody, well, you can figure out how to encrypt and sign quite easily. So even encrypting and signing is not a protection if your encryption and signing keys are out there in the wild. So we went through an awful lot of open source projects and guided them through resetting that value as part of their installer. And people set the value for valid reasons, web farms being the usual case, because it's been really hard historically to synchronize these keys across multiple machines, which we hopefully solved in ASP.NET 5 if you do a little bit of work. This one was September. This was fun. The report for this came from NATO, which was really embarrassing when you get, you know, NATO cybersecurity people going, hey, you've done something stupid. It's, oh. So I hate regular expressions with a passion, because they are really hard to get right. And regular expressions can get really complicated. They can go to this first match, then step back and look for something else, and step back and look for something else. And once you have this step back functionality, backtracking regular expressions, with depending on the regular expression, you can end up with infinite loops when you send it certain crafty values. And the only way to fix that is to add timeouts to your regular expression and then have an error case for that timeout. So the regular expression that was found to be vulnerable was part of the standard validation classes that were introduced in .NET 5.2. And someone thought it'd be a really good idea to take the client-side validator regular expressions that came from jQuery and do them on the server side. Because you don't want to believe client-side validation. You always want to do the validation at every single step. And all of jQuery's validation regular expressions for email addresses, telephone numbers, I can't remember what the third one was, were vulnerable to this, unfortunately. So we have our regular expression that comes from jQuery, and as you can see, it's quite insane, is the only kind way to put it. No one cares if you DOS your own browser. If you're going to knock yourself off the internet, that's your own problem. But when you use the same regular expression on the back end, and you manage to get a CPU spike that kills your entire ASP.NET application in one request, then we do start to care. So the demo is pretty much what you think it is. I'm going to run a good value against the regular expression. Oh, look at that. And it's an email address. And then I'm going to run the bad value. And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yep, I can warm my hands. It's still quite sunny in Seattle, it's like 20 degrees, so coming here was a shock, and this is actually quite nice. Okay, so I'm going to close that because it will never, ever finish. We have an infinite loop. So there are a few ways to fix this. Don't use regular expressions is the obvious one. What we are doing in ASP.NET V5 is that we are simplifying those validators, because really, when someone says, is this a valid email address, it's more than just getting the format. You know, you've also got to send an email to it and get a response back. That's how you would truly validate it. You've got to do domain lookups. So it's simpler on the back end now than it is in the front end if you use the jQuery validators. In .NET 4.5, and 4.52, the bits that we patched, we just added a timeout. The fun thing about the timeouts is, of course, the more load you're under, the longer these things take. It's really hard to get the timeout value right, but you can configure it. If you must use regular expressions, you either set the timeout in each individual one, or if you're using .NET 4.5, you can actually set a default timeout. Because for some reason in .NET, when you create a regular expression object, it does not have a timeout by default. It will run for an infinite length of time. So you can override that by setting an app demand setting. So those are the MSRC cases. These are the things that make me unhappy, especially the ones coming out of the German Computer Chaos Club conference, because that's over Christmas. So Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and for the next 2 days, I'm sitting biting my nails to see what they've come up with every year. Now we're going to go on to mistakes that we have seen. Mistakes that we have caught before they became MSRC cases, thankfully. So I see this one quite a bit, where people are basically trying to take strings and put them in JavaScript. So you can see that someone's trying to do the right thing, because we know when we put our strings into web pages, we should HTML encode them. But when you're doing that, you're actually putting the value into JavaScript. JavaScript is not HTML. It has an entirely different encoding structure. So what you really ought to be doing here is you HTML encode first, and then you JavaScript encode after that. If you get them in the wrong order, it can still go wrong. So encoding is very context specific. And as soon as JavaScript's there, it's really hard to get right. So we don't even want you to combine things. We feel that the right way for you to do this is you would put your values in a div tag in data fields, and then pull those values out of the DOM in JavaScript and then act upon them. Because when you put them in the div tag, HTML encoding is the right thing to do. And when you pull them out and JavaScript works on them, it doesn't need to JavaScript encode because it's pulled the value out. We don't have to worry about getting multiple encoders. This does mean a little bit more work. However, it's an awful lot safer. Then there's fun with URLs. One of the problems that we have is protecting against browser behavior and browser vulnerabilities, which gets incredibly hard. If you're using anti-XSS, you will see, and I will apologize for this now if there are anyone from Eastern Europe in the room, that outside of the extended Latin and European alphabet, we tend to encode absolutely everything. So the Russian alphabet, the Chinese alphabet, Byzantine old musical symbols, which is a Unicode code table, it exists, we'll encode those. It does tend to bloat your web page, and you can configure it by punching whitelists in the encoder for the languages that you know are safe for your application. Which has nothing to do with URLs, but I just wandered off. Okay, sorry. So you would imagine that perhaps we have a user administration page, and for some reason, people like putting parameters in URLs rather than in query strings. I blame REST for this, because it made it incredibly trendy to use your path for stuff rather than query strings. But every time I blame REST for this, people then shout at me and say, that's not RESTful. Don't care. I'm still blaming REST. So your admin could delete by hitting that URL. We all know that we shouldn't be deleting via GET requests, of course. We should only do destructive operations via POST. And we should be protecting things against CSRF via POST. But that's a whole other story. So I've seen people that are constructing the URLs in your code like this. You just take the username, and it drops into the middle of the URL. But if someone has created a username of ./admin, the browser looks at that, and it goes, oh, hold on. No, 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 I need to do a replace. And so, in fact, what would happen is it would end up deleting the admin user, because the path is rewritten. So when constructing URLs from user input, only the numbers and only the basic letters. If you have more esoteric characters, and that includes, you know, A with the O on top of it and the double dots and all the rest of the strange things you've done to the alphabet, put them in the query string. I know it looks uglier, but it's an awful lot safer. Is there anyone Turkish in the room? I asked this in Norway, and there was actually someone Turkish in the room, and I was really pleased. OK. No one Turkish in the room. So audience interaction time. Who would like to tell me or guess what the following three lines of code will do? It's either true or false, so you have a 50-50 chance. Now, I know it's not the cultural thing here to raise your head above the parapet and get everyone to look at you. But someone, please throw out an answer, true or false. Did someone say something? False. Thank you, sir. OK. No. I mean, the answer is it depends. It can be true, or it can be false, depending where in the world you are, which is why I asked if there's anyone Turkish in the room. People make security decisions based upon string comparisons. You check if a username is admin sometimes. Please don't do that. Check the claims on a security principle and or the roles and do it that way. Don't ever check on usernames. It's silly, but people do. So what you should be doing, instead of using double equals, is you should be using string.compare. And you should be using string.compare with the string comparison ordinal ignore case option. And I will show you why. But I also point out there's a style cop rule for this. Or not style cop, an FX cop rule for this. I know people hate FX cop because it gives them a lot of warnings, and everyone thinks warnings are a bad thing. And when you turn it on for the first time in a really old code base and see that you've got 5,000 warnings, you just turn it back off again. But this one is actually useful. So here we have our comparison function. And I'm going to run it. And to start off with, it is true. And then to make the one volunteer that actually interacted with me happy and not make him feel like I'm cheating, if I hit return, it's going to run the comparison again, and now it's false. And the only difference is the second one is running with the Turkish language culture. Turkey has four different ways to write the letter I, and they're equivalent in certain cases. So your string comparisons are culturally dependent. So when you do string comparisons, turn the culturally dependent options off with string.compare. And then we have Unicode. Unicode is really interesting in that for an awful lot of characters, it has two ways to represent them. you have single width characters and you have full width characters or wide ones. They actually take up 2 bytes in the Unicode spec. So it's always very hard to see, but in the second line you can see a less than, and then you can see a less than that's a little bit bolder and has a little bit more space to the left. That is a wide less than. And browsers are quite good at this. In fact, if you look at the last line, I didn't put spaces in there. Those are all wide characters. I like to think of them sometimes as American characters, because having been there for 5 years, I'm starting to get a bit wide myself. So browsers are really good at ignoring this. The script tag in wide characters does not get interpreted as a script tag. So you needn't worry about filtering out these sorts of characters to protect against XSS. Not that you should be filtering to protect against XSS. You should just be HTML encoding everywhere, because that's the safest option. And we got a report about this. It was an internal report, and the guy was very adamant that this was an ASP.NET problem. And what his site was doing is it was taking input and it was storing it in SQL. And instead of storing it in one of the Unicode fields in SQL, he stored it in a straightforward varchar field, which is ASCII. And so SQL being really helpful, it goes, that's a wide less than sign, but you can't store that. But I know the equivalent in ASCII. So it would take the wide less than sign and turn it into a normal less than sign. And so now inside his SQL varchar field, he had a valid script tag, which he then rendered back into his page. And lo and behold, we have cross-site scripting via Unicode. So you fix this just by using n varchar characters everywhere, because everything is Unicode now. You know, just get over it. There's no real reason to have varchar anymore. The other thing I should say is, and this makes the SQL DB admins really unhappy, is I don't trust data coming from databases. You should treat it with the same disrespect and suspicion that you do for user inputs coming across form fields or query strings or anything else. Because sometimes an attacker has a route to your database as opposed to XSS in your application. So if he had HTML encoded everything coming out of the database, he would have been fine as well, even if he did store it in a silly way. I have people that will ask, well, should I HTML encode on the way in? Because then I know my database is safe. No. You HTML encode on the way out, because you don't know your database is safe, you don't know your database is compromised, and upon the rare occasion that there's a bug in the encoder, well, at least if you're HTML encoding every single time on the way out, and the encoder gets updated, you'll get the benefits of that update. Things I've seen with cryptography. This is Base64 encrypted. This came from a PM on one of the Azure apps teams, at which point his developers very quickly followed up with, no, that's not true. Encoding is not encryption. No matter how much it looks like it, it's still very easy to decode, because that's what it's there to do. I've seen people try and invent new encryption algorithms, and that's always really, really funny. We have a cryptography board at Microsoft. There are people with PhDs. There are people with published crypto algorithms. There are people that have worked for, you know, the US Department of Defense and the encryption standards boards. Every time I try and do something strange with encryption, I go to them to validate what I am doing. I would never go to them with a new encryption algorithm. As huge as my ego is, it's not that big. It's very easy to write an algorithm that you yourself can't crack because you're short-sighted when it comes to your own code. It's a lot harder to do encryption algorithms that the world can't crack. I've seen encryption keys and initialization vectors be reused for multiple documents, for multiple resources, for multiple purposes. Rotate your keys, rotate your IVs every single time because of timing attacks and a bunch of other crypto analysis forms that I will talk about a little bit tomorrow. I'll talk about the historical ones as opposed to the ones that happen now, because again, the ones that happen now are just heavily mathematical and it's over my head. We have purposes for a lot of keys where you have a master key and then you derive individual encryption keys from it. So when I said that web.config has machine key and machine key is used to sign viewstate, that's not entirely true. What viewstate does is it takes the machine key and it derives a new key from it, saying this key is for viewstate. It's got a purpose of viewstate. Forms authentication does the same. It takes the machine key as a master key, then it has a purpose of forms authentication. So the keys that are used for the forms authentication tickets and view states are different. You should not mix and match, because this way you get nice individual keys. So if there is a bug in, say, view state encryption, you can't use that function to encrypt a forms authentication ticket. And we're back to this signing encrypted data. So when you have encrypted data, you must sign it with message authentication. It's not just a normal SHA-256 or an MD5 signature. You have HMAC, which is, well, it's SHA-256 underneath the hood, or SHA-1. But what it does is it takes a key. So it takes a signing key and uses that to sign the data. If you don't have the signing key, you can't validate it, and you cannot recalculate and override the signature. So you can be sure, as long as your signing key is secure, that that signed data has not changed. And the last one is interesting. I've seen people combine strings and then encrypt it, and when it comes back out again, the plain text is pretty much identical. So built in plus securely is exactly the same as built plus insecurely. So string concatenation, you should be putting the length of the original strings in as part of the concatenation. Because then when you bring it back out again, you can tell where each of the strings splits. I've also seen people validate by hostname alone, which is never a good idea. We've had a bunch of certificate authorities that have issued invalid certificates for Hotmail, Outlook, Yahoo, Gmail, and a bunch of other stuff. There's a sneaking suspicion that some of these have been state actors looking to get valid keys for Gmail so they can look at their activists' traffic to Gmail, China being the one that springs to mind, but no one's ever proved it. So when you validate certificates, you should look at the hostname, and then you should look at who has issued the certificate and check if it matches a value that you expect. Twitter, Facebook, Google, everyone, this is basically cert pinning. So they will say, okay, this is the cert that I am expecting, and I know it will be issued by VeriSign, or I know it will be issued by Thought, or whoever. So there is certificate validation by SPKI. So what SPKI does is it takes the public key plus the algorithm, and then you have a list of known good ones, and you check them. We did that sort of thing in Katana for Twitter, except Twitter was never very good about telling us when they were changing their root CA, and they've done it twice and broken our Twitter bits. But the sample code has an example of how you would extract an SPKI, and then you can use that against your own, hopefully easily updatable, list of trusted SPKI sources. We also have hash comparisons. We all know not to store passwords in plain text. We all know not to store encrypted passwords. So what we all have to do is we have to hash our passwords and we have to salt the hash. And if I have time, I'll talk about that tomorrow. But one important thing to do is when you are comparing password hashes, the comparison function should take the same amount of time whether it passes or fails. Because we're back to this padding Oracle attack thing and how that worked. If you early exit, an attacker can detect that, even over the internet, even with, you know, how slow that is, it's still pretty easily detectable. So I will go, oh, I've got the first letter wrong. And so I can keep incrementing the first letter, and then it's taken a little bit longer, so the first letter must be right, and I go on to the second letter and start rotating through. So hash comparisons should be time consistent to avoid this. And there is a .NET example of a time consistent hash comparison. Then we have mass assignment vulnerabilities. MVC and Web API use data binding to take the input and put it into the model class for you in a nice way. Data binding confuses me every time I try and use it. I end up having to go running to the MVC people asking what I've done wrong, because most of the time when I try and write data binding code, everything comes back as null. I'm just not a dev anymore. I've gotten too old. So binders will take this input and map them to object properties. And we've seen people use their entity framework models for data binding, and this is a bad, bad thing. If you could imagine a document object, a document class that's come from a database, generally the document class will have an owner field. And on your website, you're binding to this entity framework model. You're not displaying the owner. You don't need to. You're just using that in checks behind. And so you look at the output of, you know, at input 4, and you have your form, and it's only showing the fields that you want to show. It's dropping this owner off. It's dropping off last updated, all the things that you don't care about. But if I add a hidden form field with the right property name, so a hidden form field with a name of owner, model binding will overwrite that. It will, because it's valid. It sees an owner field coming in. It's going to take that value and it's going to write it out to your model. And then, of course, you're doing a check based upon that. So don't bind to your entity framework models. Don't bind to your domain models. You should use anemic view models that only have the fields for the fields for the form that you are going to display. And then you're painfully copying backwards and forwards, or you're using AutoMapper to make your life easier and that sort of thing. We also have the bind attribute, and the bind attribute has two versions. It has bind.include, where you pick and choose from the fields on your model that you want to be bindable, and that's a good way to do it if you don't want to go through the pain of a view model. We also have bind.exclude, which is not a good way to do it, because at some point one of your colleagues is going to change your database class and add a new field, and that field will be bindable by default, and they may not have thought through all the security implications of that. And for that reason, we've taken bind.exclude and thrown it out the window in ASP.NET 5. You can't do it anymore, which will probably make some people unhappy, and I'm going to get complaints, but I don't care. Path transversal. File upload is fun. The RFC says that the file name field that comes through with the file upload is just the file name. There's no directory stuff. But that's set by the browser. There's a great Firefox plugin called Tamper Data, where when you hit a form submit, it will allow you to change all the fields before it flows up. And I've seen people trust the browser name, so I can change that field name as it goes up, and I can start putting dot dot slash, dot dot slash, dot dot slash, and naive people will end up with files dropped everywhere. So you either use a unique name, or you extract just the file name out using system.io path utilities. Zip bombs, whilst we're talking about file uploading. Zip bombs are really, really funny. There is on the internet a file called 42.zip. You will have to turn off your virus scanners before you download this. And don't turn them back on again until you've deleted it. See, what 42.zip does, it's a 42K zip file. And the way zip files work is, at the start, it has a directory structure. And part of that directory structure is how big the file is going to be. And this zip bomb has a nested directory structure. And a length of the files, and then just a little content for the file. But the way that they've crafted it is, if you actually try and unzip 42.zip, remember 42K, it's going to expand out to 4.5 petabytes. I don't know about you, but I don't have that much space. Even on my Azure VMs, I don't have that much space. You can find it on the internet. Warn people you're going to test your test server with this if you have unzipping code. And the right way to do it, we've encountered this sort of thing where people want to upload zip files, is we tend to have an entirely separate process, even better, an entirely separate VM that will examine the zip file. And even examining the zip file usually means it's going to be expanded in memory. So you can't just look in the zip file unless there's a clever zip library out there that will stop after a certain amount of time. And I've not seen any of those on .NET. So we spin up separate commands or separate VMs that will try and unload the zip. And if it hasn't finished after a couple of minutes, we kill it. And then you have to clean up the mess after yourself. XML has exactly the same problems. Billion laughs. We have 10 entities here. And they're all defined as containing 10 of the previous entities, which are then, in turn, defined as containing 10 of the previous entries, and so on and so forth. So this expands to basically a billion XML objects. And again, you don't have that much memory. This one's easily preventable, though. You turn off DTD parsing on your XML parsers. That's all you can do. So things we do for you and a couple of things that we don't. Like I said, backcompat is a huge problem from a security standpoint, because it's very hard for us to break things, because we have this guarantee that we're not going to. The view state problem with SharePoint was the first ever deliberately breaking change in ASP.NET, because we took away the ability for you not to sign view state. When you installed that patch, every single view state was now signed. And some people had disabled it for really bizarre reasons, like doing cross-application web forms posting. It was quite strange. But we didn't get that many complaints. I think we got 3 from all our customer base, which is kind of good, and now means that I can make more breaking changes as and when I want, because I have my justification. So, but some things we make optional. Some of the machine key stuff, you've got to target certain versions of the framework. So as new versions of the framework come out, you should be looking at the target framework that you are targeting in HTTP runtime and updating that, and then making sure that nothing's broken. String hash code randomization, like I said, we don't turn this on by default, because there are people out there that save their hash codes. So in older versions of the framework, you can set it at runtime. I really, really recommend that you go back and do this, and then check that you're not saving string.get hash code anywhere. This one's nice and easy. Data protection. ASP.NET 4.5, we introduced machine key.protect and machine key under protect. Previously, we had encode and decode. And we're back to this whole signature thing again. We had sign and encrypt, or sign and encrypt. And people chose encrypt. They didn't have the signature option set. So now it's always both. Yeah, don't get a choice. We ignore whatever you're sending us, and we're encrypting and signing at the same time. ASP.NET has replaced this with Data Protector in version 5. In version 5, we are trying to guide you down the right path, and we're removing a lot more of the dangerous configuration values from you. So ASP.NET 5, for example, will generate keys. It will rotate keys. It will rotate machine keys every 90 days, which we've never had before, which is why we ended up with the whole machine key static in web.config. There are other things. I set my band to remind me when I have 5 minutes to go. I know that's annoying. There are other things that we want you to stop using. So like I said, you shouldn't be using machine key.encode and decode. You shouldn't be using partial trust either. It's a bit of a holdover, and we've been saying for a long time that in ASP.NET, partial trust is broken, and we don't view it as a security barrier. In the latest version of .NET, they said they don't view it as a security barrier either. What partial trust used to do was it would enable you to say, these applications can only call this API surface. And one of the more interesting ones was, well, here's an ASP.NET application. It has a trust level of medium. And medium is quite restricted. You can't, for example, spin off a new process. And if I hit play, and this is the sample you don't get the source code for, because people still depend on trust levels. So if I try and launch a shell, which is just process.start, I will show that I'm not cheating. Nope, that's the wrong one. Yes, this is WebForms, because WebForms makes it really easy for me to write quick demos. So process.start will be behind the launch button. And then behind the naughty button will be something else. But a lot of hosters used to use Medium Trust to isolate, so they'd allow code to come up that they had no idea about, and they hoped that Medium Trust would limit the exposure. So if I try and launch a shell, I get a security exception. And if I go across to the naughty button, no, really launch a shell, and lo and behold, I've spawned an entire new process, even though the partial trust settings were set to not do that. So don't rely on partial trust. We've been saying it for quite a while. It goes away entirely in .NET Core. There's no concept of it anymore. So you can't make that mistake. Damian Edwards has a presentation of what to do and what not to do in ASP.NET Security that he gave, at a tech ed a couple of years ago. That's well worth a watch. So we have 3 minutes. Because it's a Scandinavian audience, I don't feel bad about that, because Q&A is usually quite short. Does anyone want to raise a hand and ask a question? I will not take offense if no one does, because I understand this. Oh my goodness. Hello, sir. Okay, so the question is, how do we talk to non-developers to justify security? You point out everything that's been going wrong recently, I think. So you point out the Ashley Madison hack, where lots and lots of people's data got exposed. You point all the banking flaws that have been running around recently in US banks, and I'm pretty sure there are probably European ones as well. And then you point out, because you're in Europe, all the data protection regulations, where your company can end up being sued for leaking data inadvertently, and point out that there is a cost to all of these things. Not just in terms of money, but the person in charge of security at Home Depot had to resign. The person in charge, the CEO of Ashley Madison, ended up resigning. It's not just cash on the line; it's people's jobs, and the people that are hung out to dry for these things are not the developers; they're the management. Because that's a very public and visible commitment to improving things, is you fire the manager that let it happen. So if you push it personally and say that there's a cost both monetarily and probably for people's jobs, that might be a good way to do it. Also, you know, it's a small upfront cost to try and get things right. It's like unit testing. For a long time, companies didn't see the value in unit testing, and it was very hard to convince managers that it was the right thing to do. So developers tended to do it and not tell people. And then you could point and say, well, look how much time we're saving, because it's quicker to fix things in development than it is to fix things after something has gone horribly wrong. So you can use that argument as well. Whereas now I just go and stand behind people, and I have this, I have a rubber stamp that says denied that I use in security reviews. Apparently I scare our junior devs now, and none of them want to talk to me for some reason. I don't have one that says accepted, it's just denied. So I can stand behind people and tell them to do the right thing, but that's easier for me because we know that security is important. Yesterday we announced that ASP.NET was going to have a bug bounty. So for the next beta and the RC of .NET Core and ASP.NET, we will pay security researchers should they find a security bug, which is the first time we've done that for open source products, which means the next 3 months for me are going to be expensive because I will be signing off on checks. Does that answer your question? Great. It's 4 o'clock, and I realize asking questions is hard for some of you. So thank you very much for coming. I hope this has been useful. I'll be covering crypto tomorrow, which will probably be even more rushed than this because there's an awful lot to get through. But hopefully, if some of you come, it'll be useful. Thank you.